The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Hamas releases two U.S. hostages as the West presses Israel to hold off on its ground invasion of Gaza. And Israel evacuates a city near the Lebanese border amid concerns a second front of the war could open in the north.
People are concerned that if there is a real conflagration on the border, that it could become very bloody and draw, and not just open a second front in the war, but draw in major powers, including Iran and the United States.
Plus, House Republicans, still without a speaker, plan to start again on Monday. It's Friday, October 20th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. President Biden has announced the release of two American hostages that had been held by Hamas and says the administration continues work to free those still being held. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the two were safely in Israel. Hamas said it was releasing the mother and daughter in response to Qatari mediation efforts. It's the first time Hamas has released any of the more than 200 hostages taken by militants during the October 7th raid that killed more than 1,400 Israelis. U.S. and foreign officials say this comes as Western leaders are putting pressure on Israel to hold off on its ground invasion of Gaza to allow more time to win the release of hostages held by Hamas. Israel said today that most of the hostages are alive. Meanwhile, Israel has ordered the evacuation of a city close to the Lebanese border as concerns mount over the possibility of a second front opening in the Israel-Hamas war. Joining me now with more is Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent Suna Rasmussen. Suna, let's start at that possible second front. Why is Israel evacuating this city? Have clashes across the border between Israel and Hezbollah intensified?
Yeah, a little bit since the October 7th attack. It's always been a tense border, but over the last 2 weeks, we've seen sort of a slow tit-for-tat escalation on the border. Yesterday, on Thursday, there was an anti-tank missile that hit Kiryat Shemona, which is this Israeli town close to the border, which has been ordered evacuated, and it injured three people. And what was unusual about that was that it was the first time that militants from the Lebanese side of the border targeted sort of a densely populated urban area.
You visited that city. What's the situation there?
I've been to Kiryat Shemona up in the north twice this week, and it's a town of about 22,000 people, about 2 kilometers or about a mile from the Lebanese border. And today the streets were completely quiet. Most civilians have already left town, and municipality officials and the mayor told us that the evacuation will primarily seek to evacuate those who are not able to leave town themselves. And almost the only people who are around are either soldiers, including special forces, and the restaurants that are open are primarily cooking food for soldiers on the front line. And what everyone is sort of concerned about, both on the Israeli side and also on the Lebanese side of the border, is a repetition of the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah, which was very destructive and killed around 1,500 people on both sides, mostly Lebanese. But the difference between 2006 and today is that Hezbollah, the Lebanese militia, that is an ally of Iran, has grown much, much stronger. It's much better armed. And they have a decade of combat experience from Syria, where they've been fighting on Iran's side to prop up Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And people are concerned that if there is a real conflagration on the border, that it could become very bloody and draw, and not just open a second front in the war, but draw in major powers, including Iran and the United States.
Has Israel provided any additional information about plans for a ground attack in Gaza?
Yeah, the Israeli defense minister today outlined three stages of this military operation. The first stage is the one we're in currently, and it aims to neutralize Hamas militants and destroy Hamas infrastructure, the defense minister said. And that has so far included the destruction of around a third of all housing units in Gaza, which have been damaged or destroyed since the war started. And it also includes a complete blockade of everything into Gaza Then there's the second stage of the military operation, which is essentially a ground invasion, and we're all waiting for that to happen. It's a very complicated operation for the Israeli Defense Forces because they haven't been in Gaza for almost 2 decades, and Hamas has prepared for something like this for probably as long. And then the third stage of the military operation is an Israeli pullout and preparation for what they call a new security reality for Palestinians in Gaza. What that entails is something that we haven't been able to get an answer for, frankly. We just know that Israel wants to destroy Hamas, but we don't know what they envision for a political future for Gaza going forward.
Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent Suna Rasmussen. President Biden said today that he believes some humanitarian aid trucks stalled at the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt could enter Gaza as early as this weekend. Biden said he received a commitment from Israel and Egypt and that trucks could be able to cross in the next 24 to 48 hours. And the White House has requested more than $100 billion in humanitarian support for Ukraine, Israel, and civilians in Gaza. The request now goes to Congress, where the lack of a House speaker is likely to complicate matters. We'll talk more about that later in the show. As fighting continues, support from Islamist militant groups for Hamas's attack on Israel is raising fears of a possible resurgence of terrorist attacks in the West. Terrorist attacks that are deemed successful by their perpetrators can inspire other like-minded groups and individuals, as they have in the past. Joining me now with more on this is Wall Street Journal reporter Alan Cullison. Alan, as a result of the developments in Gaza, Western officials are concerned about an uptick in violence. And historically, these types of attacks have inspired like-minded groups to act as well.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much inevitable that there are going to be more attacks. First, some lone wolf independent attacks, and then followed possibly by some specific organized ones from terror groups.
How have militant groups been responding generally to Hamas's attack?
There has been praise of Hamas's attack across the board from all kinds of terror groups, even groups that opposed one another over the years. There have been regional groups, Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, TTP of Pakistan, the Taliban, all across regionally, Africa and Asia.
We've been reporting on incidents of violence in the wake of Hamas's attack. Can you give us a sense of what we're seeing beyond Israel and Gaza right now? Which areas are most at risk?
Well, I think eventually the Arab countries that have been trying to create better relations with Israel are quite vulnerable. But in Europe, it's likely to be a problem, these terror attacks, because there are such large diaspora of communities from the Islamic world. And European countries will be targeted, not only because of their lifestyles, but because a lot of them have pledged support to Israel in this situation right now.
So, Alan, in the past several years, we had been seeing the threat of terrorist attacks declining. But in the wake of this incident, are we now seeing that threat rise again?
I think you're seeing the leading edge of it. There have been a couple of attacks, one in Belgium where a fellow shot some Swedish nationals, a stabbing in France. I believe that you'll see quite a bit more pretty soon.
But turning to the U.S., what are American officials' major concerns?
Well, historically, the United States hasn't had nearly as much of a problem as Europe, probably simply because, you know, our diasporas are smaller and they're pretty well infiltrated. The United States hasn't had any problems with serious organized terrorist groups for years. They really broke them up after 9/11. And the main problem has been lone wolf attacks. And they have had them under control simply by infiltrating diaspora communities.
Wall Street Journal reporter Alan Cullison. Coming up, House Republicans plan to start all over on Monday after removing Ohio Republican Jim Jordan as the nominee for House Speaker. What's next after the break?
Enter a revolutionary business world where AI meets power with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro. Imagine PCs that boost productivity, creativity, and collaboration with cutting-edge AI. They're gateways to innovation, engineered with powerful AI performance, hardware-based security, and AI-powered threat detection. Plus, they're built sustainably and can be managed remotely. Transform your workflow with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro today. No product can be absolutely secure. Become an IT hero at intel.com/itheroes.
A Ohio Representative Jim Jordan is out as the GOP nominee for Speaker of the House. That's after a third failed vote this morning, in which he got even fewer votes than he did in the previous two rounds. Republicans then held a secret ballot, which Jordan lost. They now plan to meet on Monday night for a candidate forum. Joining me now to explain what happened and what could be next is Wall Street Journal reporter Katie Stetch-Ferrick. Katie, Louisiana Representative Steve Scalise said, quote, "We will come back and start over." From scratch? What does that mean? What do we know about what's happening next week?
Lawmakers are going to go home this weekend, and by Monday, when the candidate forum is supposed to happen, we should have a better picture of the number of lawmakers that are interested. And we expect this to be kind of sorted out throughout the weekend with people announcing, raising their hands. Some folks that we had kind of anticipated might be interested, the whip Tom Emmer from Minnesota and Kevin Hearn, and there are a bunch of other names floating around, the folks that we think might be interested. So it'll be interesting to see throughout the weekend who declares their candidacy and what kind of pitches they start making to colleagues to try to get support and endorsements.
I want to go back briefly to another plan that collapsed yesterday. You know, in my conversation with our colleague Siobhan, she had talked about how Jordan's third round of voting was a way to demonstrate, perhaps through another failed vote, that this was not the way forward and push the caucus toward elevating caretaker Speaker Patrick McHenry. That plan, of course, did collapse last night. Is it completely off the table, though?
I heard at least one lawmaker come out of the room today and suggest that that should be evaluated. With the timetable now that there'll be a candidate forum on Monday and an internal vote on Tuesday, it does seem like lawmakers are moving more towards installing a new leader and going to the House floor, getting 217 or whatever the magic number will be towards a new speaker and just sort of putting this chapter behind them instead of prolonging it with elevating Patrick McHenry by giving him special powers or making it clear that he has powers to sort of lead on an interim basis. Right now, I feel like momentum is shifting more towards closing this chapter up.
And to that point, earlier in the show, we had talked about the president's request for $100 billion in aid for Israel, Ukraine, and Palestinians. But is there a way for Congress to even approve that without a speaker? And isn't there a sense of urgency to get on with the business of the House?
Absolutely. You know, in almost every conversation we have with lawmakers who stress the need to move on, that is the first thing out of their mouths. Everyone is so concerned about making sure that Israel has the support that from the United States, that we can support them with humanitarian aid, weapons, whatever it is that they need. There's a formal request now floating out there. We didn't have that earlier this week. And so the pressure has just increased as time has gone on. I mean, there was never not a sense of urgency to get a Speaker of the House, but it's really on right now.
Wall Street Journal reporter Katie Stetch-Ferrick. In other news, Kenneth Chesbrough, a former legal advisor to Donald Trump, pleaded guilty today to one felony charge in exchange for no jail time in an agreement to testify for the prosecution in the Georgia racketeering case against the former president and others. He's the second legal advisor and third co-defendant to reach a deal with prosecutors. Yesterday, Sidney Powell, who played a leading role in the effort to reverse Trump's election loss, struck a similar deal and is expected to cooperate with prosecutors. Reporter Cameron McWhorter has more.
In 2 days, we've had two attorneys who were legally advising Donald Trump in 2020 take plea deals. So this is pretty significant, and they're both agreeing to cooperate with the prosecution, and they're willing to testify. There's clearly benefits that the prosecution got, and one of them is probably scaring the daylights out of the other remaining defendants, or certainly making their defense attorneys nervous. There are a lot of people involved here, but obviously the big name is the former president of the United States, and he was named repeatedly today as part of what the prosecution argues is a criminal enterprise to overturn his loss in 2020. People we've been speaking to about this case in particular in Atlanta, they're saying this is prosecution 101. You indict a bunch of people under this RICO statute, and you try to get the people on the lower rungs to flip up the line.
The U.S. and Europe have failed to agree on a path for eliminating Trump-era tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Trump imposed the tariffs in 2018, citing national security concerns. The Biden administration and the EU later paused the dispute and are hoping to negotiate a new deal by January. Reporter Kim McCrail says resolving the dispute is straining ties between the allies during a time of geopolitical crisis.
The reason this is so important, especially from the European side, is that they're very aware that there's a U.S. election approaching. And as much as there has been a lot of great cooperation, the two would say, on a lot of different issues under the Biden administration, they really would like to get the issue of some of these trade irritants, such as the steel and aluminum tariffs, resolved before the election, because there's some concern that if you have a different outcome in the election, and if, for example, the current leading Republican candidate, Donald Trump, is reelected, that dealing with tariffs could be a lot more difficult.
And that's What's News for this week. Today's show was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Anthony Bansi. What's News is hosted by me, Anne-Marie Fertoli, and Luke Vorgas. Additional support this week from Mohsen Ali, Keith Collins, Jessica Fenton, and Catherine Millsop. Our supervising producers are Sandra Kilhoff and Michael Kosmides. Aisha Al-Muslim is our development producer. Scott Salloway and Chris Sinsley are our deputy editors. And Valana Patterson is The Wall Street Journal's head of news audio. We'll be back with a new show on Monday morning. Thanks for listening.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost-effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.